listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the April 2024 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the cover story. Queen Anne. Anne Hathaway has become a style icon to Gen Z and embraced who she is after years of self-recrimination and internet noise. With the racy romance, The Idea of You, hitting theaters, the Oscar winner talks about living out loud. By Julie Miller. With photographs by Norman Jean Roy. Styled by Deborah Afshani. Anne Hathaway is wearing high fashion outfits and was photographed in January in New York City. It's a gray Manhattan morning, but Anne Hathaway and I are sitting in a restaurant so dazzlingly white, it looks like the afterlife scene in a movie. The Oscar winner is warm and considerate. I arrive 10 minutes early, and she is already seated, in a white sweater and pale blue jeans, at a table she thought would be best for my recording purposes. The restaurant's menu is strictly plant-based. We order green chickpea hummus, market beets, and honey nut squash. But Hathaway's diet is not. Later, she'll deadpan, "I think everybody can agree I have the personality of a vegan." Hathaway has been famous for more years than she hasn't, and is well acquainted with the internet's noisy opinions. She's undergone an existential overhaul in the last 5 years or so, a period that coincided with giving up alcohol, new motherhood, turning 40, and treating herself with more grace. "This is the first time I've known myself this well," she'll later explain. "I don't live in what others think of me. I know my own mind, and I am connected to my own feelings. Also, I'm way quicker to laugh now." Her newfound clarity is evident on screens and red carpets, where she's debuted a kaleidoscope of vivid colors and edgy silhouettes that have earned her Gen Z approval. Donatella Versace called the formerly pristine star dangerous but sexy, the ultimate compliment for a Scorpio, and chose her to front her Icons campaign. Hathaway accompanied the designer to last year's Met Gala, where she was a best-dressed revelation in a tweed gown held together by pearls and safety pins, a la Elizabeth Hurley, hair teased to 90s supermodel heights. This May, she stars in and produces Amazon's adaptation of Robin Lee's sex-positive romance novel, The Idea of You, in which she plays a 40-year-old divorcee who finds love with a 24-year-old Harry Styles-esque boy band member, Nicholas Galitzine. Now 41, Hathaway tells me she's proud to depict a fully realized woman experiencing her sexual bloom at the time of life when women are told they'll become invisible. The restaurant we're in is not just vegan but high vibration, meaning that the food is as close to its natural state as possible. For Hathaway, reaching her own high vibration is tricky with a recorder running. "The idea of anything you say being picked to define you is daunting," she says. She's not as serious as interviews make her seem, she tells me. But as we first start talking, at least, she's definitely careful, present and engaged, but also pausing to mentally scan answers for web-flammable sound bites before sharing them. You don't want to say anything to provoke any kind of reaction, but you also don't want to say something that could be misinterpreted, she says, as we begin. "I'm feeling a little goldfishy." "What do we do to get out of that?" I say. "I have no idea," Hathaway says. She grabs my hands across the table and says, "Let's discover it together." A waiter arrives with the beets, an abstract painting of crushed purple and orange on a white plate. It's the most gorgeously presented root vegetable either of us has ever seen. That's beautiful, Hathaway says, on the heels of being like, no, I swear I'm not that earnest. I die over beets. Years ago, in one of their Key and Peele sketches about the hilariously manic hotel valets, Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele confronted all the snark about the woman they reverently referred to as the Hathaways. After seeing a tabloid article mocking the actor, Key and Peele exploded with open-mouthed, hyper-speed, strangled voice indignation. They cited her resume, sang their own rendition of I Dreamed a Dream from Les Miserables, and asked an incisive rhetorical question. Would you be hating on the Hathaways? Confident woman in Hollywood whose sole character flaw is that she cares too much? She certainly owns who she is. I'm an intense person, Hathaway says at the restaurant. We're talking about how, when she was a three-year-old in New Jersey, she saw her mother play Eva Perón on stage and knew in every cell of her being that she wanted to act. She'd come and see me in things and concentrate with the most rapt attention you can imagine, her mother told a reporter many years ago. Hathaway's parents, her father as a labor lawyer, tried to dissuade her from acting professionally. As her mother put it, my husband and I had seen perfectly nice children become little monsters. But Hathaway is not easily talked out of things she believes in. She took drama classes, understudied future Tony winner Laura Benanti in a production of Jane Eyre at 14, and had the chutzpah to write to an agent with her headshot at 15. You can tell from that story, I don't do things by half measure, she tells me. When I love something, I imagine myself doing it to the hilt. There was a fleeting moment when Hathaway decided she wanted to be a nun. But it turned out that you can love God without being a nun, she says. She later learned you can also love God without being a Catholic, leaving the church because of its stance on homosexuality. As she once told British GQ, why should I support an organization that has a limited view of my beloved brother? Hathaway's mother gave up acting to raise the kids, so the dream Hathaway dreamed was just to support herself as an actor. If she was successful, maybe someone might know her name. The last thing in the world you expect is that it's going to go this way, she says. For 20-plus years, she has roamed expertly among genres. If you look at just the titles of her best movies, it's hard to imagine what they have in common until you realize that it's her. The Princess Diaries, Brokeback Mountain, The Devil Wears Prada, Rachel Getting Married, The Dark Knight Rises, Les Miserables, Interstellar, and three greatly deserving indies, Colossal, Armageddon Time, and Eileen. Hathaway goes all in on her characters. For her Oscar-winning turn in Les Miserables, she lost 25 pounds to play the desperate Fantine and suggested shaving her head after researching the time period and realizing it would be an authentic detail. She also requested more than 20 takes of I Dreamed a Dream, even though the director thought she'd nailed it on the fourth take. Hathaway tells me that sometimes, while filming, she will be so in the zone that it's like she leaves her body. The truth is that you let go. You black out a little bit. You come up at the end and you're like, what just happened? James Gray, who wrote and directed Armageddon Time, remembers Jonathan Demme raving about Hathaway after directing her in Rachel Getting Married 16 years ago. He talked about how great, intense, and brilliantly committed she was, he says. He said, this is someone you're going to want to work with. Gray continues, when you're looking at actors, you're looking for a level of commitment. It doesn't mean they have all the answers, but it does mean that they will give themselves 100% to whatever they're doing. Gray cast Hathaway essentially to play his mother in the semi-autobiographical film and says she was so devoted that she tried to perfect his mom's chicken cutlet recipe, down to the way she dunked the poultry in the egg wash. And by the way, Jeremy Strong and Tony Hopkins were the same way. They were willing to do anything for me. It makes me want to cry thinking about it now, because it's very rare that you get that. Michael Showalter, who made The Idea of You, says Hathaway cared about everything from the interior design of her character's house to what pens she used. She's fiery, he says. She has deeply held feelings about things that you can feel intractable. I'm a Gemini. Things changed constantly for me. Once we put an astrological sign to it, that opened up the floodgates for us to communicate in a different way. I'm not joking, and I'm not an astrology guy. But even I was like, oh my God, of course, I understand you now. It's just that you're a Scorpio. Well, yes, and, as the saying goes, at least one reason Hathaway prepares so thoroughly for her roles is surprising and non-astrological. I'd rather not be unseated on the day of filming by my anxiety, she says. Part of the way I can tell myself that I am okay is by having such a complete level of preparation that if I get a critical voice in my head, you can quiet it down by saying that you did everything you could to prepare. Early in her career, she says, I had a horrible anxiety attack, and I was by myself, and I didn't know what was happening. I certainly couldn't tell anybody, and it was compounded by thinking I was keeping set waiting. Now I feel much safer going to someone in charge, pulling them to the side, and explaining, I'm not going through this right now. Most people will sit there with you for the 10 minutes it takes for you to come back down. Hathaway has learned that there can be a personal cost to the deep dive. She just had an edifying experience filming David Lowery's Mother Mary, an epic pop melodrama in which she plays a singer enmeshed with a fashion designer, played by Michaela Coel. There was an intimacy coordinator on set, not just for sex scenes, but for any scene in which the actors felt especially stressed or emotionally exposed. It was a godsend, she says, to have someone there who was making sure, in a moment of vulnerability, when you're showing something true and sacred to yourself, that you're not going to be harmed. When Hathaway's star was first on the rise, everyone had an opinion about how she should handle fame. All the advice that you're given is to protect yourself. Everybody's dangerous, and everybody's trying to get something from you. People were advising me that I armor myself and keep that distance, and that I have two selves. The outward-facing Hathaway, they meant, and the private one. But figuring out one identity is daunting enough, let alone two. I found that terribly confusing, she tells me, so I don't do it that way. I'm not armored. Which is a boon for acting, because your emotions are accessible, but when you're criticized, it's acutely painful. She doesn't love to look back on the time when people mocked her for high crimes, like, say, co-hosting the Oscars, as if it was an honor and mattered. When you do everything right and society hates you for it, read a BuzzFeed story in 2015, that's Anne Hathaway syndrome. In 2022, during a Women in Hollywood speech, Hathaway said that the vitriol toward her cut even deeper because it mirrored her own. This was a language I had employed with myself since I was 7. And when your self-inflicted pain is suddenly somehow amplified back at you, at, say, the full volume of the internet, it's a thing. Says Gray, we live in such a brutal, ironic, postmodern moment that everyone thinks if you're sincere, you're somehow full of shit. Speaking about social media, he says, it handles a certain kind of sincerity very poorly. It is much more attuned to a snarky viciousness, and it tends to demean a seriousness of intent and purpose. Hathaway tells me that period didn't just mark a personal low. Even though she had won an Oscar, she says, a lot of people wouldn't give me roles because they were so concerned about how toxic my identity had become online. I had an angel in Christopher Nolan who did not care about that and gave me one of the most beautiful roles I've had in one of the best films that I've been a part of. She's talking about when Nolan, who'd previously directed Hathaway as Selina Kyle in The Dark Knight Rises, cast her in Interstellar as a scientist sent to space with Matthew McConaughey. I don't know if he knew that he was backing me at the time, but it had that effect, Hathaway says, and my career did not lose momentum the way it could have if he hadn't backed me. Humiliation is such a rough thing to go through, she continues. The key is to not let it close you down. You have to stay bold, and it can be hard because you're like, if I stay safe, if I hug the middle, if I don't draw too much attention to myself, it won't hurt. But if you want to do that, don't be an actor. You're a tightrope walker. You're a daredevil. You're asking people to invest their time and their money and their attention and their care into you. So you have to give them something worth all of those things. And if it's not costing you anything, what are you really offering? Hathaway is friends with her two-time co-star Jeremy Strong, Serenity, Armageddon Time, the similarly committed and unarmored Emmy-winning Succession actor. Strong asked to write me an email about Hathaway rather than talking on the phone, ostensibly because he was in the midst of Broadway rehearsals for Ibsen's An Enemy of the People, but also, I suspect, because he wanted to get his thoughts exactly right. In an age of increasingly curated and performed selfhood, I think Annie has an understanding that any step away from authenticity, any cultivation of an idealized persona or bulletproof image, will necessarily erode what a person has to offer as an artist. Annie is committed to the steeper path of growth. She puts her heart and her backbone into growing, as an artist, as a woman, as a mother, as a friend. Siri Hustvedt once wrote, "Only the unprotected self can experience joy." I would say the same is true for life and for art. You have to cast off your protective covering to really experience it in an embodied way. I think Annie is interested in joy, in joyfully doing her work, and joyfully, consciously living out loud. She does not hide, and she is not afraid, which makes her a radiant person and a fearless actor. In short, why would anyone be hating on the Hathaways? During one of our conversations, we talk about how scary it is to think about our children encountering the cruelty of the Internet. I must look distraught, because Hathaway again takes my hands in hers and asks if I'm okay. I ask her what she'd tell a young person who finds themselves on the receiving end of cyber hate, given her unintended doctorate on the subject. That night, when Hathaway has trouble sleeping, she emails her answer. What she'd say to them is, "Your hurt is real. I want to hug them, make them tea, and tell them to live as long and as well as they can," she writes, "that there is an excellent chance that the longer they live, the smaller this moment will feel, that I wish them a life a million times more fascinating than this terrible moment." In 2019, Hathaway announced her second pregnancy on Instagram, and if you look back at the post, you can see some evidence of how she's willing to make herself vulnerable. Along with a black and white photo of her baby bump, she wrote, "It's not for a movie. All kidding aside, for everyone going through infertility and conception hell, please know it was not a straight line to either of my pregnancies. Sending you extra love." I ask her about that moment. "Given the pain I felt while trying to get pregnant," she says, "it would have felt disingenuous to post something all the way happy when I know the story is much more nuanced than that for everyone." In 2015, Hathaway had suffered a miscarriage during a six-week run of the one-woman off-Broadway show Grounded. "The first time, it didn't work out for me. I was doing a play, and I had to give birth on stage every night," she says. When her friends came to visit her backstage after performances, she told them the truth. It was too much to keep it in when I was on stage pretending everything was fine. I had to keep it real otherwise. So when it did go well for me, having been on the other side of it, where you have to have the grace to be happy for someone, I wanted to let my sisters know, you don't have to always be graceful. I see you, and I've been you. Her eyes well at the memory. It's really hard to want something so much and to wonder if you're doing something wrong. Hathaway was shocked to learn that many of her friends had gone through similar experiences and found a study estimating that as many as 50% of pregnancies end in miscarriage. I thought, where is this information? Why are we feeling so unnecessarily isolated? That's where we take on damage. So I decided that I was going to talk about it. The thing that broke my heart, blew my mind, and gave me hope was that for 3 years after, almost daily, a woman came up to me in tears, and I would just hold her because she was carrying this pain around. And suddenly it wasn't all hers anymore. When she wrote that Instagram post, she says, it was more about what I wasn't going to do. I wasn't going to feel ashamed of something that seemed to me statistically to actually be quite normal. Hathaway says she's become gentler in her time as a mother to Jonathan 8 and Jack 4, her sons with her husband, producer Adam Shulman, and extends that softness to herself. When I was younger, the way that I knew how to improve was by being hard on myself. There's a ceiling to that path. I had to relearn what it means to have drive, but to do it in a nurturing way. And that's when you go, oh, if there's a ceiling, I haven't discovered it yet. Her new mindset is possible in part because she stopped drinking. I knew deep down it wasn't for me, she says, and it just felt so extreme to have to say, but none. But none. If you're allergic to something or have an anaphylactic reaction to something, you don't argue with it. So I stopped arguing with it. She wants to make it clear that she's not saying this from a place of self-righteousness or judgment. It's a path everybody has to walk for themselves, she says. My personal experience with it is that everything is better. For me, it was wallowing fuel, and I don't like to wallow. The thing that I have faith in is that everybody else is going to have one or two drinks, and by the time everybody gets to two drinks, you'll feel like you've had two drinks, but without the hangover. All this is to say that Hathaway takes much better care of herself now than she did when she was 20. I make a lot of my lifestyle choices in service of supporting mental health, she says. I stopped participating in things that I know to be draining or can cause spirals, and it's clearly not just about alcohol. I actually don't have a relationship with myself online. The next time I see Hathaway, it's a sunny Monday morning, and she's sweeping into the lobby of Condé Nast, the parent company of Vogue as well as Vanity Fair. The pop cultural significance is not lost on her. 18 years earlier, her Devil Wears Prada character did the same on her way into her fateful job interview at Runway Magazine. This time, the actress wearing a dandelion-colored trench coat and sunglasses. When we get to the elevator bank, she deadpans in her best Andy Sachs, "Hi, I'm new here." 34 floors above, in a lounge surrounded by windows, we marvel at the view of the southern tip of Manhattan, the Statue of Liberty, and beyond that, New Jersey, where Hathaway grew up chasing soccer balls, watching Pretty Woman on repeat, and dreaming about acting. As a kid, she noticed how different men's and women's roles were in movies. Young men were encouraged to pursue their desires, and young women were encouraged to be desired, she wrote to me after our interviews. One is active, the other is passive. I always identified more with being active, which made me a misfit at times. Hathaway was told she had no sex appeal when she started in Hollywood, which she never believed. I was like, I'm a Scorpio. I know what I'm like on a Saturday night, she tells me. The irony is that other people's opinions about her sex appeal could exempt her from roles, but not the industry's predatory climate. But the cultural definition of what was sexy was narrower then. The male gaze was very dominant and very pervasive and very juvenile. Because of what was being reflected back at her from movie screens, she spent her 20s, like many women, more concerned about optics than emotional well-being. In an email, Donatella Versace says of Hathaway, "Her power and beauty really caught my attention, but what gives her real strength is her kindness and compassion." Hathaway now knows that the question, "How do I feel?" is more important than the question, "How do I look?" And it's made her more comfortable on screen. "I feel ready to be a sexual creature out loud," she says. The Idea of You novel became a pandemic sensation because of its love scenes, yes, but also because of the escapist, about-time quality of its December-May love affair and what it says about an aging woman's worth. Hathaway says she appreciated that her character, Solane, is a complete person before she meets her love interest. The film is different from the book in that Solane is less Tony and more relatable, but the sex scenes are still very sexy. It's not like one healthy, consensual female orgasm, okay, multiple, is going to change the world, Hathaway wrote to me. But I'm really happy to be a part of a story that takes pleasure in female pleasure. Just as she was informed that she wasn't sexy when she was young, Hathaway was told her career would nosedive when she hit 35. She hasn't forgotten that. Before Greta Gerwig and Margot Robbie took on Barbie, Hathaway and a friend, Ocean's 8 co-writer Olivia Milch, were attached, and it sounds like their script would have explored ageism-adjacent terrain. As Milch puts it, the idea of a Barbie who feels like an outsider and doesn't make as much sense in Barbie land anymore. Milch echoes Hathaway's own praise for Gerwig's movie when she adds, "The version we were working on was wonderful and exciting, but I'm so glad that the version that exists is the one that is in the world." Hathaway doesn't gloat when she remembers those old prognostications about a nosedive. She talks about how grateful she is that she can still help movies get made. "You never know how long that's going to last," and admits that, despite everyone's best intentions, not everything works. "I have definitely cashed a few of my chips in recently, but there's no denying, for instance, that her turn in the thriller Eileen last year, she played a platinum blonde prison psychologist who captivates a young woman working there, was one of the most assured performances of her career. And there's no shortage of upcoming projects. Often unexpected narratives about women to keep Hathaway's life work at a high altitude. Next up, Hathaway and Jessica Chastain will star in the psychological thriller Mother's Instinct, as women whose relationship fractures after the young son of Hathaway's character dies in a freak accident. Hathaway signed on to the role as a new mother, but because of scheduling conflicts and the pandemic, the project didn't start filming until her oldest son was close in age to her character's son. "I couldn't back out on a friend," she says, meaning Chastain. But the experience was sufficiently harrowing that Hathaway found she couldn't eat on set. "Even though I loved the people I was working with, I needed to get out of there when it was done and never look back." After Mother's Instinct, Hathaway and Salma Hayek will produce and star in an action buddy comedy called Seesaw Monster, Netflix's adaptation of the novel by the Japanese author Kotaro Isaka, who also wrote Bullet Train. Hathaway will likely always get questions about a potential Devil Wears Prada sequel from fans hoping to manifest more Andy, Emily, and Miranda. At the end of every performance of the Broadway show Gutenberg, the musical, surprising celebrities appeared as producers and added a grace note to the plot. In January, Hathaway showed up with Anna Wintour, the inspiration, of course, for Meryl Streep's Miranda Priestly. On stage, Wintour introduced Hathaway as her assistant, to which Hathaway, mock dejected, responded, "Still?" Then, in late February, the actor reunited with Streep and Emily Blunt while presenting at the SAG Awards. But Hathaway will never do a Prada sequel because the media landscape is digital these days, and she prefers her movies to be true escapes from everyday details like texting. Looking at my recorder, she feels that itchy need to clarify. "I'm just realizing this as I talk to you," she says. "I haven't turned to my team and said, only send me movies that predate the personal computer revolution." In January, Hathaway did have an honorary moment as a Condé Nast staffer when, during the first attempt at taking photographs for this article, she left the set in solidarity with the Condé union members, taking part in a one-day work stoppage as they negotiated a new contract. Hathaway's own guild, SAG-AFTRA, had just waged a 118-day strike, so her sympathies were clear. The shoot was rescheduled for the following day. In the meantime, she trended on social media, and Vulture ran the headline, "Anne Hathaway, formerly of Runway, walks off photo shoot in support of union." When Hathaway goes viral now, it's generally for celebratory reasons. For instance, a handful of videos of her connecting with fans have captivated certain corners of the internet. In a video taken in Rome in 2022, Hathaway, wearing a sparkly pink Valentino skirt suit, addresses frenzied fans and photographers, telling them, "Calma, calma, amore." In another, taken in London last year, the actor, wearing a red couture dress in the shape of a rose and thigh-high boots, soothes a crowd of fans and tells them how things are going to go. "Do not move, please. I'll come to you. We are not going to push. This is very calm." There was no sound to the video, so a deaf content creator posted a TikTok lip reading that was liked more than 3.4 million times. "So much poise, class, and talent," one commenter wrote. "She's an assertive queen. Good boundaries and safety awareness are awesome." When I bring up that last encounter, it's clear that Hathaway has no idea what I'm talking about. These are regular occurrences. But she remembers events by what she was wearing at the time, so I describe the thigh-high boots. "You're going to have to give me more," she says. "I wear those a lot." Pretty Woman is still her favorite movie. "The thing is, we all have nervous systems," she says, when we're on the same page, then pokes fun at herself. "I have a very intimate relationship with my nervous system." She pauses. "People just want to be seen, and in that moment, we can get on a wavelength together." Hathaway says Julie Andrews taught her what it meant to be a gracious star when she made time to sign autographs at the end of each day on The Princess Diaries. She respected that they had a relationship to her work that spanned their entire lives and made it a beautiful experience for them, she tells me. "I don't know that I was always capable of that, so I've learned that I want to handle myself in a way that I'm going to be proud of at a later date. These days," Hathaway tells me, "what I feel more comfortable with is letting things happen." Though she doesn't say it, that sounds like a significant step forward for someone shadowed by anxiety and by critics, including herself, for so long. Last year, Hathaway was captured on camera dancing to Lady Marmalade by LaBelle at a Valentino after-party during Paris Fashion Week. "I turned and I realized I was being recorded," she says. "When I scowl," she says, "but I didn't do that." Instead, she told herself, "I'm in a nightclub and I'm dancing and this is the world. Don't stop. Don't perform. Stay where you are because you feel great. Despite," she stops herself, "despite nothing. Why wouldn't anybody wearing Valentino at a nightclub in Paris, dancing, feel great. Her unapologetic happiness was viewed more than 20.7 million times on TikTok. And by the way, she tells me, if I watched you, I would think you looked great, and I'd be really happy for you, too. Out of sight. Inside Apple Park, CEO Tim Cook talks exclusively to Vanity Fair about the genesis of a mind-blowing new device that will shape his legacy and perhaps how we see the world. By Nick Bilton, with photograph by Norman Jean Roy. Opening photo, moonshot. Tim Cook wearing the Apple Vision Pro in his Cupertino, California office in January. The first time Tim Cook experienced the Apple Vision Pro, it wasn't called the Apple Vision Pro. It was years ago, maybe 6, 7, or even 8. Before the company built Apple Park, where we're sitting right now, at a bleached oak table in this incredible circular edifice clad in miles of curved glass. It's been raining, and the clouds are clearing over the pine trees and the rows of citrus and maple trees, and the sun is reflecting off the pond in the meadow, and it's kind of mesmerizing. And Cook's telling me about that time, all those years ago, in his dulcet Robertsdale, Alabama accent, when he first saw it. It was at Mariani 1, a nondescript low-rise building on the edge of the old Infinite Loop campus with blacked-out windows. This place is so secret, it's known as one of Apple's Black Ops facilities. Nearly all of the thousands of employees who work at Apple have never set foot inside one. There are multiple layers of doors that lock behind and in front of you, but Cook is the CEO and can go anywhere. So he strolls past restricted rooms where foldable iPhones and MacBooks with retractable keyboards and transparent televisions were dreamed up, where these devices, almost all of which will never leave this building, are stored in locked Pelican cases inside locked cupboards. This building, after all, is folklore to Apple. It's where the iPod and the iPhone were invented. The same building where Cook finds the industrial design team working on this thing virtually no one else knows exists. Mike Rockwell, vice president of Apple's Vision Products Group, is there when Cook enters and sees it. "It's like a monster," Cook told me, "an apparatus." Cook's told to take a seat, and this massive, monstrous machine is placed around his face. It's crude, like a giant box, and it's got screens in it, half a dozen of them layered on top of each other, and cameras sticking out like whiskers. "You weren't really wearing it at that time," he told me. "It wasn't wearable by any stretch of the imagination." And it's whirring with big fans, a steady, deep humming sound on both sides of his face. And this apparatus has these wires coming out of it that sinuate all over the floor and stretch into another room, where they're connected to a supercomputer, and then buttons are pressed, and lights go on, and the CPU and GPU start pulsating at billions of cycles per second, and Tim Cook is on the moon. He's sitting right there on the effing moon, with Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong of Apollo 11. He looks around, and there's the ghostly luminescence of ancient dust under a black star-studded sky. It's magnificent. It's amazing. There in the distance is the Earth, the blue dot, where all of this magic is happening. But Cook's not just on the moon. He's also in that secret room, in that secret building. And he can see Rockwell and other Apple employees, and he can see his own hands. And he knows right then and there what this all means. Like the universe is telling him something. He knows that this is the future of computing and entertainment and apps and memories, and that this crude apparatus wrapped around his head will change everything. He knows Apple has to make this thing its next product category. What Cook didn't know is how his engineers were going to take this thing that needs a supercomputer in another room and fans and multiple screens and shrink it down to the size of a pair of goggles that weighs a little more than a box of spaghetti. "I've known for years we would get here," Cook told me. "I didn't know when, but I knew that we would arrive here." The first Apple Vision Pro, in a perfect white cube the size of a large shoebox, arrived in stores in February. Cook was on hand at the flagship New York store, where hardcore fans waited hours for the doors to open. Apple reportedly sold around 200,000 units out of the gate. Of course, the early adopters are easy. What Cook and his army of executives know is that the company still has to convince everyone else that in their own daily lives, for work or entertainment or meditating, or capturing the most surreal family memories, or all of the above, they need to spend $3,500 on a spatial computer, a headset that makes you look, as a friend put it, like you're going skiing in the Matrix, and on which you can't access popular apps like Netflix and Spotify, at least not yet. It won't be hard to get people to try the Apple Vision Pro. Buying it may be another story. Though fortunately for Apple, those who have already strapped one on seem more than willing to preach about all the wondrous things it can do. I would say my experience was religious, the director James Cameron told me when I asked him about his first encounter with the Apple Vision Pro. I was skeptical at first. I don't bow down before the great God of Apple, but I was really, really blown away. Another prominent filmmaker, Jon Favreau, offered a similar sentiment, telling me he was blown away by the technology and what it will do to storytelling. Favreau created content for Apple specifically to showcase the device's 3D capabilities, where a dinosaur climbs out of a screen and looks like it wants to eat you. I'm excited by what kind of story I can tell now that I couldn't tell before now, he said. And when I called Om Malik, who has been writing about tech since tech reporters wrote about calculators, he was even more effusive. It's amazing. It's incredible, he enthused. You can feel a vibration in the universe. Everyone else I spoke to who has had a chance to try out the Apple Vision Pro, investors, whoa, and designers, wow, and analysts, ooh, and producers, ah. I was thinking about all of those whoas and wows and oohs and ahs as I walked up to the Steve Jobs Theater, a round building with walls made of nothing but glass that hold up a massive cylindrical roof that looks like it's resting on air. It was my first time visiting SJT, as they call it, an homage to the man, the legend, the guy who dreamed all of this up. An Apple employee walked out holding a Pelican case the size of a lunchbox, and I knew what was inside. Yeah, it's one of those. And seeing him reminded me that when I had first spoken to Apple months earlier, I had absolutely no desire to try what was inside that case. Zero interest. Not an inkling. I didn't watch Cook's June keynote about the Apple Vision Pro. I didn't read the dissecting blog post or the uninformed conjecture on social media. I just kept scrolling, like I do when I see anything about Harry and Meghan. I told Cook this as I sat with him in the same room where he did that keynote, because I've seen this play before, and I know what the first act is like, and the second act, and I know how it ends. Back in 2013, in a conference room in Los Angeles, I strapped an Oculus VR headset to my head for the first time. Oculus, a well-funded startup, would later be purchased by Facebook, which would later rename itself Meta. It was cool, sure. I offered my proverbial wow and gave out a few oohs and ahs as I played a video game with brutalist, square-pegged, square-edged graphics that looked like Pablo Picasso had smoked too much opium and designed a digital world. But after a few minutes, I felt claustrophobic, and by the intermission, I was mired in an existential crisis that maybe I had stopped inhabiting the real world because I could only see myself in the virtual one. Over the last decade, as the graphics became smoother and the chips faster, the same thing kept happening with each new VR device. Rift, Vive, Quest, Quest 2, and Quest 3. I used them all once or twice, and then they went into a drawer or a cupboard or a box in my basement, because I didn't want to feel the claustrophobia of putting something on my face. Then last August, I was invited to Apple's Los Angeles office, formerly the home of Beats, to experience what I thought would be yet another VR device. I was sitting in a sleek room with white oak furniture and polished floors, and all I was thinking about was how long it would take me to get home, And whether I take the local streets, because the 405 by that hour is just a nightmare. I sat on this gray couch, and an Apple employee told me to reach out and grab the Apple Vision Pro in front of me and place it on my head, which I did, reluctantly, just wanting to get this over with. And then, as I expected, the world disappeared, as it always does with VR headsets. But that only lasted for a few seconds, because a digital curtain pulled back, and behind it was the real world. I could see my arms and legs, and then the Apple app icons popped up in front of me like a multicolored apparition. This was as far from a VR headset as a kid's Schwinn bicycle is from a Gulfstream G800 private jet. Just as when I scrolled my finger around the wheel of the first iPod, or used my finger and thumb to zoom into an image on the first iPhone. With the Vision Pro, I could look at an app icon and simply tap my fingers together, and the app would open. And then it was hanging in front of me, in the clearest resolution I'd ever seen in my life. I could swipe through images with my hands, move things with my fingers. Unlike other VR headsets, where you have to use a controller that feels like you have lobster claws for hands, with the Apple Vision Pro, your eyes become the mouse absolutely seamlessly. "It's mind-blowing," Cook said to me when I told him about my experience. "We live in a 3D world, but the content that we enjoy is flat." During that first demo, I went to the iconic Mount Hood Stratovolcano in Oregon, and I could hear and see a million raindrops falling into Mirror Lake, so much so that I felt like I was there, and the only thing missing was the earthy scent of rain-soaked soil. I interacted with graphics in midair that were crisper than anything I'd ever seen before, and I touched them all with my fingers, not a mouse or keyboard. I saw spatial videos for the first time. To say this feature is astounding is an understatement. You actually feel like the person is in front of you, and you can reach out and touch them. I saw clips of movies that were 100 feet wide, sharper and clearer than any IMAX. But most importantly, I saw the world around me. That very room, I didn't feel closed off or claustrophobic. I was there. I was everywhere, all at once. I left the Apple offices that day and went to a nearby coffee shop, and when I opened my laptop, a relatively new computer, it felt like a relic pulled from the rubble of a Soviet-era power plant. You know, one of our most common reactions we love is people go, "Hold on, I just need a minute. I need to process what just happened," said Greg Joswiak, Apple's senior vice president of worldwide marketing, as we ate lunch at Apple Park. How cool is that? How often do people have a product experience where they're left speechless, right? I wasn't really left speechless until the second demo. A few months after my initial experience, I went back to the LA offices. Two Apple employees led me into a room. I put on the Apple Vision Pro, and the curtain opened, and I was looking at them. The only difference this time was I had a cup of tea with me. In the middle of this new demo, I reached down and grabbed the tea and took a sip. And as I did, one of my fingers flickered, like I was in a simulation no different from reality, and there was a glitch. "Wait, what am I seeing?" I asked, confused. "Are you real, or..." "No, you're seeing a video of us that's being rendered in real time," one of the employees explained. I sat there for a moment, speechless. I had thought what I had been seeing was the real world, and that all the digital wonder was layered on top of that. That the Apple Vision Pro was transparent, and there was a layer of technology on top of it. In reality, it was the other way around. "I think it's not evolutionary, it's revolutionary," Cameron said to me when I told him about my experience, and I'm speaking as someone who has worked in VR for 18 years. He explained that the reason it looks so real is because the Apple Vision Pro is writing a 4K image into my eyes. That's the equivalent of the resolution of a 75-inch TV into each of your eyeballs, 23 million pixels. To put that into perspective, the average 4K television has around 8 million pixels. Apple engineers didn't slice off a rectangle from the corner of a 4K display and put it in the Apple Vision Pro. They somehow compressed almost three times as many pixels into a space as small as your eyeball. This, to people like Cameron, who have been working in this space for two decades, solves every problem. But even with all this wonder, with 23 million pixels that are so clear and crisp that you can't tell reality from a digital composite of it, there are some problems Apple hasn't solved, at least not yet. There's an old story about Steve Jobs that has become folklore in Silicon Valley. It takes place about 25 years ago in that same nondescript Black Ops building, Mariani 1, where Cook would see the first Apple Vision Pro prototype years later. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock, Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.